history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty remarkable stories out there waiting to be told if we will take a little time to just ask a couple questions and listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We certainly want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we are educated. We learn a lot. We are also entertained and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I have a feeling this story is going to take a while with Dr. Bert Marius. Fitzalbert Michael Marius, 95 years old, of Fresno, California, but born in Panama, grew up in New York City, has a story that I don't know if we're going to be able to do justice to today. And I've just been walking around your house here in Fresno with you. And you've got all these incredible paintings on the wall. Each one of them has a story. You've got all these manuals you've written. You've published books. You've got cabinets you built out of wood, sculptures carved out of wood. I'm trying to think, what am I leaving out? I mean, you've got golf trophies and a scratch golfer. How do you have time to do all these things, Mr. Renaissance Man?
Well, the point is, I just simply have priorities, and I don't waste any time at all.
I guess not.
I take care of things, and people are always asking me, God dog, Bert, how do you have time to do all this stuff? I say, I just don't waste the time. I use it effectively and efficiently.
I know you do, and I just remembered what I left out. You were part of the first open-heart surgery in this city where you live because you were a heart doctor here forever and ever in the city of Fresno, only retired a few years ago. So I left out probably one of the more time-consuming elements of all these passions that you have. But let's go back to the beginning. And people right now are scratching their heads, and they're saying the same thing. How does this guy have time to do all those things and do them so well? But let's start at the beginning. You're born in Panama, but you probably don't remember Panama, huh?
I don't remember a thing about Panama. Everything I remember about Panama is what Mama told me. Because I remember I wasn't quite 3 years old when we immigrated from Panama to Harlem, New York. The first memory I have is living in that first apartment building there, 137th Street at 8th Avenue. We lived up on the sixth floor, and it was a very, very interesting situation because they were called railroad apartments in those times, and the railroad apartments don't have any hallways. Each room goes from one room to another, so you had to learn to respect each other. And on top of that, there were two apartments on each floor, but only one bathroom in the hallway for both apartments. So you had to learn to live with other people with respect. And it had an influence on the attitude that I developed.
Oh, I'm sure. And how big was that apartment and how many people were living in it?
Well, the particular apartment we were living in those times, we lived together. We all lived in the same building and quite often in the same apartment. In that apartment, my grandmother lived with me, my grandfather, two of my aunties, mm-hmm. and my whole family, you know, and down the line like that. And at that time, my mother and father, you know, my sibling under me, Everett, was born in that apartment.
And I guess I should go even further back to establish where you're coming from. I'd like to share a little bit about where you've come and all the things you've accomplished. But your parents were both from the West Indies?
Yeah, my mother and my father were both born in St. Lucia, which was a former French-speaking island, but it was owned now by the British. You know, it was one part of the British West Indies, and it was a French-speaking island. So I grew up speaking French and English. And how I was born in Panama was my father, when he got married to get a job, he worked for the Panama Canal Zone. And so just the first two of us, my older brother Hugh was born in Panama City at one side of the Panama Canal, And I was born in Colon, Panama, on the other side. But we didn't know it until World War II. But we were born citizens because we were born in a territory owned by the United States. But we didn't know it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you found out in World War II because it was convenient for the government to have you guys in the service.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that. But so growing up in Harlem in the 1920s and 30s through the Great Depression.
Right.
I have to imagine that was a much different world from the world you live in today.
Absolutely. There's no way to compare what happened. Now, I say this, and it's hard for people to believe because they talk about the recession, you know, during the time of Obama and all that sort of stuff. But we had what they called the 1929 Depression. But I can say this from experience, that what they called the Depression back then was much better off than what we call the recession today, because money was worth money. You had the gold standard, which didn't go away until 1935 with Franklin D. Roosevelt, but you still had the silver standard until Richard Nixon in 1973. So you could not create any money without having the backup of gold or silver, not like today. You can print as much pieces of paper as you want. You can say it's worth this and worth that, but it ain't nothing but paper. They ain't got nothing to back it up. My dad supported 6 children and a wife, and he made $7 a week, and we never went hungry at all. So the money was worth something. I remember going to A&P, and my mother spent $2.50, and I used to have her carry the bags of groceries home. Today, you spend $2.50, and you'd be searching all through your pocket trying to find where did I put it? So times have changed a lot.
Yeah, that's a great way to illustrate it. Did you see suffering around you, though, during those years? I mean, you're on the other side of Manhattan from the place where that stock market crashed in 1929. How did you see the world change during those years?
Well, I was young, of course, but the whole issue was you got to remember certain things. That during that time, there was very little or no government intervention in how the people operated. There was no such thing as welfare. Even during the Depression, the only food that was given out was certain wheat products and cheese. But the cheese and the wheat products were donated to the government by the farmers. Mm-hmm. Had nothing to do with the government. They were just distributed it. There was no such thing as government helping in a tornado or a hurricane. All the cities around sent people over there and helped them to rebuild the stuff. Even during the Depression, when people were unable to pay rent in your community, nobody stayed out in the street in Harlem, in the community that I lived in the tenement community, more than 15 minutes. Their furniture and stuff was put out 15 minutes later. All their furniture were in various people's houses. We took their children in. Nobody stayed out there, and we helped each other. But that doesn't happen today.
And I don't think I need to ask which model you thought worked better.
Of course, you know, I like that model. Because one of the things that model, you learn that if you're down at the bottom and you don't make any effort to produce, you're going to be at that bottom forever. You had to help the other person down the line, and we considered each other, which is something that doesn't happen. Fathers took care of their children. They took care of, not that, you know, you didn't have people doing wrong things. Of course they were doing wrong things. But they didn't come out and have a parade about it because they knew it was wrong. It's not like today. But times have changed. Back then, because of that, guess what the low tax was during that time? 1%.
I know I don't need to ask you which one's better for you that way.
Yeah, that's right. And especially with the money is worth what it's worth, you see. So, yes, and we learn that. I tell the young people, I do a lot of motivational talks in the colleges and universities and primary schools and high schools and so on down the line. I tell them that they can produce, but they have to have the right attitude. And it's like my mother told me, she said, Bertie, if you just be a ditch digger boy, you better be the best ditch digger in the whole world. So whatever you do it 100%.
Do you have ditch digging on your resume, too? Because I didn't see that.
Yes. When I was over in the South Pacific, I dug a lot of ditches, kid. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about when you were that little boy
in
Harlem, because I understand that's where you figured out your artistic gift. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just making this up. I mean, I just got a tutorial on some of the artwork you've done over the years. It's clear you've invested a lot of time. You've employed a wide variety of artistic styles, from Rembrandtian to the Picasso-esque in there and everything in between. When did you figure out that you had a gift for art that maybe your siblings or other kids didn't possess?
People hardly believe it today, because up until I was 17 years of age and ready to consider going to college and stuff like that, I was an absolute introvert. When you came up to Bert Maris and you'd say, hey, Bert, how you doing? I said, hi, I'm doing fine. We had our conversation. And that was it. I was an introvert. I had to teach myself to talk. I mean, when I got ready to go to college, for 6 months I got in front of the mirror and I would tell myself I was the audience, and I'd look at myself, and I kept talking until I learned to talk to myself. And when I went to college, what I would do when I had to present something, I would just look at one person in the audience and make believe it was me in the mirror. And that's how I learned to talk.
That's probably good advice for a lot of people listening. But if you take yourself back to that little boy growing up in Harlem, what was little Bert's dream? What was your ambition?
Well, my main ambition had always been this: to be another Rembrandt or Leonardo da Vinci. I never wanted to go into medicine or nothing else. I wanted to be a Rembrandt, because my means of communicating my attitude and thoughts and feelings was in art, writing, poetry. So I didn't know how to speak to people, to communicate. I'd get down and write a poem, or I'd paint a picture. And that way I'd learn, and that's way the Lord had blessed me with that talent and line. And then what happened was, when I went to Frederick Douglass Junior High School on 143rd Street between Lenox and 7th Avenue at that time. It is not called that now today. And it was on the south side of the street, and County Cullen, one of the Harlem Renaissance poets, was my teacher. He was my teacher in French and English. And County Cullen, you know, encouraged me to continue in art, you know, because naturally he was in art himself. So down the line, after I graduated there, and I went to Stuyvesant High School. And Stuyvesant High School at that time was one of the number one scientific high schools in the whole United States. And you had to pass a specific test to pass it. And obviously, I was a good student, you know, because I was persevering and what you call it, and I did a lot of research and a lot of reading and so on down the line. So I went to Stuyvesant High School, and I was one of the few blacks there. As a matter of fact, I didn't even go to my graduating class, because I just knew the people in my specific class, you know, and I think there were about 3,000 people or something like that who graduated. And I didn't know. I didn't go to graduation. I went and picked up the certificate, but I wasn't involved in anything at all there. But I graduated from Stuyvesant High School, you know, and I was always a good grade. And when I graduated from Stuyvesant, I was 17 years old, and I'd received a scholarship to Pratt Institute, which is an art institute in Brooklyn, New York. And I went there for about a month. I didn't like what they were doing and stuff, so I left and I did some studying at the Art Students League in New York. Then after that, I spent 9 months in Greenwich Village with a buddy of mine, you know, and that was during the Depression.
It was, but wait till you hear some of the names he was rubbing elbows with, or more directly, the famous musicians providing the background tracks for his late-night poetry. And later, something he can laugh at now, but something that nearly cost him his life, a case of mistaken racial identity you're going to have to hear to believe. Find photos and videos featuring Dr. Marius online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the unique story of Dr. Bert Marius of Fresno, California. He'll turn 96 in March, and he's kicking off Black History Month for us with a journey that includes the 3 months he spent as a white man. What? Yeah, that's what I said. I'll let him explain it in a bit. We left off just before World War II. Bert was just a teenager, but he was already an expert custom tailor and an accomplished violinist, among other things. And he was living with a friend in Greenwich Village, where he would become pretty familiar with what we recognize now as some of music's biggest names.
Of course, it's $10 a month, and most months we couldn't raise the $10. But we ate because there was a Village Vanguard down there, which is still in existence today. And the Village Vanguard was started in about 1938 by an Italian guy who wanted to create this nightclub to promote music, you know, jazz music and poetry and writings and stuff like that. And we talked, and they used to have jam sessions there. So Count Basie and Jimmy Lunsford and all those, Ella Fitzgerald and all those people used to come down after they'd finished from about 2 to 4, and they'd have jam sessions. And I met all those musicians down there. And me and my buddy would sit down, and as they played the jam session, we would write the poetry, and we'd get up and recite it to the music, because they're playing blues or something, you know. There was a girl who came to me last night, you know, boom ba doo ba doo ba doo ba doo ba doo. And then we would recite the thing. Yes, we walked down the street with this girl you need, and torn down the line, and so on. And we recite the poems, and we don't know how many of those poems they used and stuff down there. But that's how he fed us. Uh-huh. And that's how we ate. But that's all I wanted to do.
Well, and a lot of questions come to mind. It almost sounds like you're a pioneer of rap by doing that with the poetry, with the beat going behind you. A little different beat,
but
maybe.
It wasn't rap. You know, it wasn't rap at all. It was pure poetry, and we recited it. We didn't sing it. Instead of the music, we just simply recited the poem, right. You know. Yeah. Right.
And I didn't mean to denigrate your poetry by comparing it to hip-hop.
No, there's some of the rap that has good, what you call it, you know, but most of it I don't understand a thing.
Well, I know one thing you do understand, probably as very few others do, the racial situation in this country. Mm-hmm. And today there's tension. There are those who want to see racial reconciliation. I'm curious for you. In those days, before World War II, how did you view that situation? Did you see discrimination and bias? Did you experience that yourself? Was that something that was out of sight, out of mind? What was your view of it then?
Well, you see, we didn't have all of the sidetracks and social nuances that's associated with it. We dealt with the reality. Now, there was no doubt in the mind of blacks that there was prejudice and discrimination. You were limited to certain things you could do. Blacks could not go into architecture because you couldn't make a living. There were very few scholarships available. You couldn't get into most white schools. If you didn't have a job as a janitor or anything like that, there was no such thing as a black being a blank bank clerk. Or clerk or none of that kind of stuff. Teachers were restricted to black areas for teaching and so on down the line. You know where you stood. So you knew you had to move from the bottom up. And there's one good thing that you knew this. You could not depend on the government because the government was controlled by the whites. And at least when you were in Mississippi or Georgia and that kind of stuff, you knew exactly how you should act and what you should deal with. When you walk down the streets, when I had visited various places like that, you learn. A white man's coming down the street this way and you coming that way, you stepped off the curb and let him pass. You also learned you never looked in that area a white woman in the eye because they had a blue law, and it was blue law called eyeball rape. If you looked a white woman in the eye, she could call the cop and call you. They arrest your butt, put you in jail, and arrest you for eyeball rape. And many blacks never got out of that jail. They committed suicide, they said.
And you knew of actual instances where that happened?
Yes. Wow. I knew of instances where that happened. All right. So you learn a whole lot of stuff. The young people, blacks, today have no concept of all of what discrimination was. They think they're being discriminated, but they're not utilizing what they have. As I pointed out to them, I said, now, the whole issue is my family had five boys and one girl. All right. And one girl, she got in there because she was a twin, or else she wouldn't have made it. But the top was, all five boys in my family, and I tell this to the students in school when they ask, you know, how can you make it if you don't have income to pay for college? My people had no money, you know, they're just living from week to week and so on the line. My mother got paid 25 cents an hour for working as cleaning up people's houses. She just worked a few hours here and a few hours there. And my father was making the $7 a week. But we managed to make it. So they had no money to pay for our tuition and go on the line. But we helped each other. My older brother, to tell people, even without any help and so on down the line, and helping yourself and the inspiration and the drive of your family and so on down the line, you can still make it. My older brother wound up with 3 degrees. He wound up with a BA from City College, a master's from New York University, and a PhD in political science from Université de Paris in France. He wound up being not only a politician, but he wound up speaking 8 languages fluently. He was very familiar in his politics with Bill Clinton and other kinds of people. He was on the line. He was the associate commissioner of markets in New York City. He was commissioner of environs and commissioner of something else. And he also wound up to being the director of the Commission of Alcoholic Beverages of the state of New York. Now, when he finished, he helped me. I wound up in medicine and so on down the line and art and various other kinds of things. We both went and helped the brother under me, and he wound up with a master's in civil engineering. The brother under him wound up with a master's in biochemistry. My youngest brother wound up with not only a master's in electrical engineering, which he worked for one of the biggest companies and the best, strongest companies there for about 2 years, decided that's not what he wanted to do, went back to medical school, and became an internal medical doctor. And we all did that helping each other, not with scholarships or anything else.
And I guess the question is, because you know how unique that is, mm-hmm. and how extremely impressive that is, but rare, and if it were that easy, everybody would do it, right? So what was the secret? Why do you think that happened in your family as opposed to other families?
Well, it's not just my family, but remember, it was the attitude and heart of the people helping each other. We weren't thinking only of me, myself, and I. We were thinking of us. Now, there was a tradition in my family, you know, coming, and it's a West Indian tradition in St. Lucia, that when you got to be 7 years old, there were two things, choices you had to make. One, a trade that you wanted to get involved in, and number two, a musical instrument that you wanted to play. Now, my older brother, Hugh, his musical instrument was a piano, and he turned out to be one heck of a pianist. As a matter of fact, if he hadn't gone into politics and stuff, he'd have been one of the outstanding pianists. He was outstanding. And he chose watchmaking and jewelry. And what you do is you go in after primary school at 3 o'clock, you'd go in and spend 3 hours every day in apprenticing and then work on Saturday, and you did that till you about 14, 15, 16 years of age. I chose tailoring and went to Mr. Ross's tailor shop, and he was originally from Barbados. I did that every day until I was 16 years old, where I became an expert custom tailor, and I could make anything. But I could make enough money during the summer to pay my tuition in college, and it's tailoring that helped me. And so on down the line. Besides that, you know, we spoke more than one language and down the line, and we knew how to help each other and knew that you had to be productive. You could not have an attitude of entitlement simply because your butt woke up in the morning. You were entitled to the opportunity to seek employment, but you weren't entitled to the product of the employment without working. And you knew that from the beginning. So that's how we got into that, and that's what helped me all the way through college and everything else that I did.
And you mentioned the tailoring. Is that something you still do every now and then?
Not every now and then. As I showed you in there, I still got my sewing machine. I still show. And before you leave here, I'll show you a couple of things that I've made stuff like that. So no, I still tailor. As a matter of fact, I make all my own caps, and I made, you know, pants. I used to make dresses. I make coats for my wife, and uh-huh. you know, I design it and make. Because I learned all of that stuff. I could make fur coats, gloves, you name it. I knew how to make those kind of things.
And that was only half the family tradition. You said a trade and
the
an instrument.
Was an instrument. Well, I chose the violin. It turned out that a lady by the name of Miss Greedy that lived on Broadway on 145th Street, she was a lady that donated her services to the black neighborhood down there. She had a music studio. She would say someone wanted to learn to play the violin and so on down the line and the piano. You could come and she would teach you free. The point is, Miss Greedy was tough. If you didn't show up, she came down the hill and came down to your house and got your butt and took you up there. But I learned the violin from the scratch, and I played. I still got my violin in there, and I still play it. But, you know, the violin is one, if you don't play it every day, you lose the nuances and stuff, you know.
Sure.
People say, oh, it sounds good, but don't it sound like crap to me because because I know what it's supposed to sound like.
One more thing about the pre-war time. I've interviewed some other folks. Monty Irvin, a great baseball player from that part of the world, served in World War II, but was a great ball player before and after. So I'm wondering about, in a sports realm, mm-hmm. You talked about some of the musicians you interacted with and the jam sessions in Greenwich Village. What about sports? Did you have, New York's such a big sports town, did you have some sports heroes back in those days?
I had a lot of sports heroes, of course, you know. There's no greater sports hero during my time than Joe Louis. Mm-hmm. All right. We only had the radio. You know, such thing as television or nothing at that time. And that's the time when Franklin D. Roosevelt had his fireside chats. And I remember we used to run home to hear him on his fireside chat. You know, he had a way of really reaching into, you know, and you didn't really understand because his wife, Eleanor, was really the one who worked towards getting rid of racism. But he was a smooth politician. He always sounded on the top, but he was working with the people that's against, was pushing prejudice. But he never sounded like it. He always sounded good in you, except for what he said. He had a way of putting it over that you believed him. But anyway, we'd go home, or let's hear one of the fights with Joe Louis. You know, those are the two things I remember running the radio and going to down the thing. Now, he was, and then Jackie Robinson.
Yeah. He wouldn't break in the major leagues till later, but they did have the Negro Leagues going on. Did you ever hear anything about that?
Oh yes. Matter of fact, I used to go to the Yankee Stadium and watch. As a matter of fact, I went to the game where the first time the Yankees played against the Black League there.
Was it like an all-star team from the Negro Leagues?
Yeah, well, it was their limited team that they used to play and stuff like that, and they beat the heck out of the Yankees.
Do you remember any of the players?
Yeah. You know, Babe Ruth played in that one. And Satchel Paige. Satchel Paige struck them suckers out. I was in that game in Yankee Stadium.
Wow.
Yeah. So those were days, you know, that was different than today, you know, because blacks had to do things that it was very easy for you to be the first black that. Because black didn't have very many opportunities.
Well, that's one way to look at it, as an opportunity, when most looked at it as a brick wall that was impenetrable. Mm-hmm. But what you guys did in World War II played such a role in those color barriers falling in sports and in culture afterwards. You mentioned the fireside chats with FDR.
Yeah.
So what about Pearl Harbor? Is that how you heard about that, too? Was it from FDR?
Well, now, there's how I wound up in the Army on December 7th. 1941. I can still see that in my mind. I was at Lincoln University. I started Lincoln University in 1940. And I was sitting there, and I was not going to Lincoln University majoring in pre-med. When I went to Lincoln University, I majored in architecture because it was associated with art. And so, you know, a lot of people, because here when I got in Fresno and went into general surgery and wound up with Frank DeBakey in San Francisco. That's when Stanford Lane was up in San Francisco before it moved to Ann Arbor in the days of the dinosaur. So I was in on the early things concerning the modern day heart surgery, you know, as we're known, and heart transplants and all those sort of things. Matter of fact, when I was at Stanford Lane, I worked with Norman Shumway in the dog lab doing heart transplants on dogs. Although, you know, historically, you find that a man by the name of Christian Bernard did the first heart transplant in South Africa. And he did that first transplant because he came to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where Norman Shumway was, and Norman Shumway showed him how to do it and stuff. But, you know, the whole point is how I got into medicine. Well, back there, after, you know, he gave that talk and said that we are now at war with Japan, we're involved in the war. It wasn't a shock to me because the whole issue was, at that time, we were isolating ourselves. we should have been involved against Hitler and stuff, along with France and Great Britain and stuff, but we isolated ourselves. That's their problem. And so the only way we got involved in World War II was when Japan chose to attack Hawaii. So anyway, what happened? At the time, one of the guys came over to me and said, now, they got an ASTP program associated with this, and that program is a different kind of program because there's a lack of certain kind of specialties in the Army. And they've put together a special program for people who are in pre-med. Instead of you going 4 years through pre-med, what they now in that new ASTP program have is that after 2 years of pre-med, they take you out of the pre-med and they put you through a concentrated 2 years of medical school. And in 4 years, you are MD instead of eight. Now, I got to thinking, now I'm working all summer. And then I'm doing while I'm at school, in order to eat, I'm washing dishes in the kitchen. And I said, now, I don't have to do this another 2 years if I join this program. And plus that, they'll pay for my medical school. So I moved and became pre-med, and that's how I got into medicine.
Funny how that works, huh? Yes.
It didn't have nothing to do with me, because all I wanted to do was be an artist.
So it was World War II that shifted the path of his life toward medicine, but it didn't exactly proceed as planned. When we come back, the bizarre interview in which one fateful answer triggered a significant change of course for Dr. Bert Marius. Check out those photos and videos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Hey, this is Paul Leffler from the Hometown Heroes program, and I don't want you to miss out on a powerful exhibit that's traveling the country. Courage and Compassion, our shared story of the Japanese-American World War II experience, is in Kingsburg until February 4th at the Kingsburg Historical Park. Take your family, take your school group, take everyone you know, because this free exhibit will help you understand sacrifice, perseverance, community, and the value of freedom. For more information, call 559-410-0488.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our wide-ranging interview today with 95-year-old Fitzalbert Marius of Fresno, California. He's a gifted painter, sculptor, tailor, golfer, author, teacher, you name it. But he made his name as a pioneering heart surgeon. You heard him say before the break that it was World War II and specifically the Army Specialized Training Program, ASTP, promising a shorter path to becoming a doctor that caused him to pivot toward medicine. That path did not play out as expected, though, thanks to confusion over his racial identity and then a detour into some dangerous duty before the war was over. Let's pick it up, Dr. Marius, when you first joined the Army.
I joined it. That was in December 1942. I joined, enlisted in the Army under that thing. At the end of my second year, they took me out of there and came down at Oxford, Pennsylvania, and picked us, all of us who had joined that program, and took us up to Fort Dix, New Jersey, where we would be interviewed. So I wound up at Fort Dix, and now this is very, very interesting, and if it hadn't happened to me, because as you know, back in that time, the Army was absolutely segregated. No blacks could be in a white organization, part of the Army, mm-hmm. And on top of that, very few black officers. The officers over most of the black units were white officers who did not meet the qualifications to be over the white units. And they became the lieutenant and the captain over your units, like they were over mine. And they had certain kinds of things, myths and so on, during that period of time. Like, during that period of time, there were, you only had four races. It's not like today, you know, with the multiplicity of stuff that they have. The four races, white, colored, yellow, and red. And you had to fall in one of those four categories. And there were no other categories you fell into. So, and blacks, of course, fell under colored. So I wound up there, I remember, going in for my interview. And they also had, there was a myth among the whites at that time that you did not look a black male directly in the eye all for any long periods of time, because if you do, it was just like walking on the ladder or black cat crossing or being on the 13th floor.
Oh boy.
So they didn't look at you. Uh-huh. So when I went in, this white lieutenant was sitting on the other side, and I went in and stood up at attention, you know, and he said, not looking up at all, he's looking down at the paper, and didn't look up at me the whole interview, and says, relax, soldier, sit down. So I sat down, and I'm looking, but he never looked at me, and he began asking the usual questions, says, name, Fitzalbert Michael Marius. Now, that ain't a name like Jim Brown, and on top of that, I had a New York accent with some inflections of the West Indian accent in it. Sure. At that time. So I didn't say y'all, yas, boss, you know, none of that stuff. So I didn't have nothing Southern, nothing sounded like a colored man. And a name fits. Albert M. Marius? All right. Place of birth, Colon, Panama, not Biloxi, Mississippi. He went on down the line as education. 2 years of college. Now, most blacks at that time was lucky to make it to the fifth grade. And he just went on and on and on and on. And then he got way down to the, what you call it, do you speak any other language besides English? And I said, yes, sir, I speak French. Because I grew up speaking French. Now, none of these characteristics match anything colored. These characteristics are written down there are the characteristics you find associated with an intelligent white man. So after a while, he looked at the paper, and then he looked up for the first time, and you could see this, his eyes open wide, because what he saw did not match what was on the paper. So he said to me, he says, soldier, private, are you colored? And at that time, I was not very... You know, I didn't have the insight that I have now. If I'd have simply said yes, I'd have gotten into the program. But instead of that, I said, what do you think? And he looked at me and looked at the paper several times. And then he took out something and he wrote something on the paper and it says, soldier, you're discharged. You may leave. And I left. And the next morning, I was the only person of the group that received an order to get on a train to head for Denver, Colorado, at Fitzsimmons General Hospital. So naturally, I'm a soldier, I obeyed it. And I got all the way to Denver, Colorado, got to Fitzsimmons General Hospital, and it was a base about 1,600 to about 2,000 men. And I was the only individual on that base this color. Everybody else on that base was white. It was a 2.5 to 3 month program where they trained you to work with doctors on the field, you know, as a doctor's assistant, a nurse, you know, and so on down the line. So they put me in a barrack, and I was on the upper bunk, the top of the bed, and at the bottom bed was a young white guy from Georgia, and his father was the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
Now you got to be kidding me. I mean, all of this is hard to believe, but that one, I mean, what are the odds of that?
Yeah, well, the odds of this is, and like I said, if I hadn't experienced it myself, it would be hard to believe, with the Army segregated. So the whole time that I was there, the 2.5 to almost 3 months, I slept with the one eye open because They verbally abused me every opportunity you get. I can't tell you the things they called me. And whenever they got an opportunity, they physically kicked my butt. But just about a week or so before the time was concluded, six of them caught me off to the side by myself, beat my butt up really bad, and then grabbed me by the feet and had me hanging upside down, dipping my head into a barrel of oil where they were going to drown me. And fortunately, a captain came by. And naturally, you know, captain has to follow his orders and not allow any soldier to harm another soldier regardless, you know. So brought no charges against them at all. But anyway, after I left there, I went to Camp Barkley, Texas, which is outside of Dallas. And it was the first time, you know, I didn't know, you know, how did I wind up here in this situation? And naturally, the captain was a white captain, and he was also from Georgia. You know, and he was, then I'm standing at attention, and he's looking at the record, and he just fell out laughing. And naturally, I never changed the expression on my face because you learn as a soldier, you know, how to act, you know. And I just stood there watching. And then finally, after he laughed a while, he reached and got a big, long stamp, which was about 8 inches. And then he stamped right across the middle of the document, colored. And I said, oh, my God. This stupid lieutenant had put down there that I was white. And that's how I wound up in Denver, Colorado, because what he probably said to himself was this. Now, this guy was born in Colon, Panama. Now, he's of dark skin, but he speaks a different language, and no color. None of these characteristics meets colored. If I'm going to make a mistake, I would much rather make the mistake the other way around than putting a white man with blacks. So when the Army was completely segregated, Fitzalbert M. Marius, for almost 3 months, was white. but almost got me killed. It was the worst 3 months that I've ever spent in my whole life.
And I've got to ask you, I mean, you tell the story so well in such captivating fashion, and I don't think you left anything out, but I'm just imagining you, as you described, six guys have grabbed you, so obviously fighting back is futile. They've got you outnumbered. They've overpowered you.
Yeah.
And they're hanging you by your ankles, dipping your face into a barrel of oil. So what's going through your mind as that is happening?
I'm getting killed. That's what's going through my mind.
Yeah.
That's all that's happening. I'm not thinking of nothing else. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking I ain't going to make it.
How close do you think you came to being killed right there? I mean, how much longer would it have taken if that guy, the captain, didn't come by?
I don't know. You know, I have no idea of knowing. All I can remember is they were killing my butt, and fortunately the captain came by and my life was saved. Now, little details about how many minutes it was, none of that made any effect on me. The major aspect was my life was saved. And that's all I can remember. Yeah.
And every veteran I've talked to, it seems like, has at least one moment where his life was spared. Most of those, though, are in the war, not here in the States before you ever got to war, because of this extreme case of mistaken identity that I guess really underscores, not to get up on a soapbox and not to be master of the obvious, but doesn't that underscore the fallacy and erroneous idea that these racist thoughts originate from? I mean, doesn't it expose how stupid racism is?
Of course it does. Of course it does. But it does not change the sociological and social system. Your social system changes from the heart, not from the intellect. You see, you can make all the laws you want. It will not change the way a person feels. They'll work around the laws. I mean, I did the same kind of stuff myself, working around the law. Now, before I gave myself over to Christ in 1967, I lived a life of what I would have called integrity, because I was always an honest man. I didn't lie. I told the truth. If I made a commitment, I kept it. Now, the commitment may not have been the right thing to do, but I kept it anyway because I was a man of my oath. Uh-huh. My mother told me, Bertie, don't you ever make an oath you don't keep. You hear that, boy? Mm-hmm. And I can still hear her now telling me that. So I kept those kind of oaths. I didn't go out. I was raised Catholic, so marriage meant one woman, one time and stuff. So I wasn't out running after a whole bunch of other women or none of that kind of stuff. But I was just following orders. It was no change of heart involved. And that only occurred after I accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior in 1967, in March the 3rd. And I remember that date very specifically because it was 2 days after my birthday, March the 1st. Mm-hmm. But that's where the difference came, remembering and having a change of heart. You see, not an intellectual attitude, but a change of heart. So anyway, when I wound up in the South Pacific and in all those areas you read about, Guadalcanal and Bougainville and all those places, I was there. Yeah.
Well, and let's talk about how you ended up there. So they, so we don't lose a segment of the story here. You're in Denver, you almost are killed, they figure out this paper's wrong, he's clearly not Caucasian, they put that big colored stamp on your file.
That's when I went to Camp Barkley, Texas, and went through basic training.
With other African-American troops?
Of course, I was black again. I was one among the white folks no longer.
How was that different, being with an all-black unit and going through basic training with all black soldiers all of a sudden after the time you'd spent surrounded by nothing but white soldiers?
Well, the number one thing, I was not concerned. I could sleep with both eyes closed. And nobody was going to cuss me out because I was black. They had other reasons too, which they did later on, but not because I was black.
And that feels like the perfect place to hit the pause button till next time, when we'll explore Dr. Marius's close calls in the Pacific and some more of his incredible life. More than 15,000 heart surgeries this pioneering doctor participated in. And you heard him say he does not waste time. He recently launched another lengthy course at the Fresno School of Mission, where he tries to teach prospective missionaries how to understand the culture of the people they're hoping to reach before they venture into foreign lands. Life is quite the adventure for 95-year-old Dr. Bert Marius, and I know we don't usually have the same voice for you two shows in a row, but if you enjoyed today's conversation, I know you're going to love our next episode. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.